The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs,
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. Moishe Piston is a Western Marxist and a professor of history at the University of Chicago. He is also the author of the book Time, Labor, and Social Domination, a book that won the American Sociological Association's Prize in Theory. Piston is a guest on this podcast, and he discusses an essay he wrote entitled Anti-Semitism and National Socialism. It's Wednesday, October 18th, 2017, and I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. If you're looking for a book to help you understand late capitalism, pick up Aslam Japp's The Writing on the Wall, which is a collection that brings an understanding of Marx's value theory to bear on political questions. Terry Tapp's A Serf's Journal is another good pick. It tells the story of the longest wildcat strike in U.S. history. And of course, Angela Nagel's Kill All Normies is a good read, and it's turning out to be a great conversation piece. As I always say, it makes every leftist get-together into a struggle session. If you're a current member of the Zero Books Club, or if you're interested in listening to Inside Zero Books, the second podcast each week, I want to let you know that we're moving from the Zero Books blog to Patreon. This will make it easier for you to listen to the members-only podcast on a mobile device using a podcatcher. You can find links to our Patreon subscription page and get that second hour of Zero Books, the podcast, in these show notes. Right now, the latest episode of the Insider podcast is a conversation with C. Derek Varn and I analyzing the movie Blade Runner 2049. The music you're listening to right now is music for Pieces of Wood by Steve Reich. But in just a moment, you'll be listening to Moishe Piston and I discuss anti-Semitism as a symptom of capitalism. Moishe Piston is a Western Marxist and a professor of history at the University of Chicago, and he is the author of the book Time, Labor, and Social Domination, a book that won the American Sociological Association's Prize in Theory. In this episode of our podcast, Piston and I are going to discuss another essay he wrote entitled Anti-Semitism and National Socialism. So, Moishe Piston, thanks for coming back to the Zero Books podcast.
Sure, Doug.
So, let's just jump right in to your essay. It recontextualizes the kind of racism that you see on the fascist right. It shifts the context a bit around the kind of racism that we see, this sort of politicized ideological racism, rather than say structural or unconscious or implicit racism. You frame anti-Semitism as being a particular kind of racism that's different from, say, racism against Muslims in Europe or Mexicans in the United States. So what is it about anti-Semitic racism that makes it different?
Okay. Anti-Semitism actually is a complex phenomenon, and I was trying to isolate one strand, which I think is the most important strand of modern anti-Semitism, because there are some forms of anti-Semitism that are a lot like other forms of racism. you know, that too many Jewish immigrants, Jews are dirty and loud, et cetera, et cetera.
Uh-huh.
But that, although extremely widespread, isn't something that leads to a policy of extermination. And I was trying to analyze a policy of extermination, which is different than mass murder. Mass murder, I mean, not that one is better than the other, but extermination really is an attempt to wipe out everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So that the Nazis, even as late as 1944, the second last year of the war, they're deporting Jews from the Greek island of Rhodes and sending them by boat and then by train to the camps in the east, even though their armies are being smashed already by the Red Army in the east. So how do we understand this kind of program of extermination? And I tried to suggest that extermination implies threat, but of a very particular threat, that is, anti-Semitism is tied to the notion, modern anti-Semitism, that the Jews pose a threat to, quote-unquote, civilized society. And a lot of people misunderstand Nazi anti-Semitism as being the Aryans are the superior race, and Jews, among others, are an inferior race. Inferiority alone does not lead to extermination. They regarded the Slavs as inferior, and their plans for the Slavs, after killing thousands of, let's say, Polish intellectuals, priests, people who could possibly lead an uprising in their minds, they were perfectly willing to enslave the rest as slave labor.
Mm-hmm.
This isn't an option for the Jews.
What is it about the Jews that made them be perceived as a threat, an existential threat in this way?
I mean, I think that has to do with historical contingencies.
Mm-hmm.
The Jews in Europe had no civil rights until the modern period. They simply, people who think that, you know, Jews who lived in Germany or in France were simply like, you know, Frenchmen and German with a different religion, that's wrong. They were treated as a different people, and they were very starkly proscribed in terms of professions they could engage in, etc., etc. The Jews were generally, in France it was a little earlier, but in Central Europe they were emancipated, that is, given civil rights in the mid-19th century, just as those societies undergo a massive transformation as a result of capitalist industrialization. You have the destruction, basically, of what had been small town and peasant society, and the rise of these huge cities with a large working class, the rise of a different kind of culture, different kinds of music, new journalism. The Jews were associated with that, in part because they stepped onto the stage just when these changes were taking place. Mm-hmm. So really what I'm suggesting, if I can go sort of skip ahead two steps,
mm-hmm.
is that the transformations of capitalism that really affect people's lives in very fundamental ways, they're mysterious. It's almost never a discourse of politics. It's not something that can be understood simply in terms of the policies of states. What you have is the churning constantly of a social structure, and there's nobody to blame. It's abstract. it's very abstract. And these abstract forces of capitalism, I suggested, become personified as the Jews, as a Jewish plot, as an international Jewish conspiracy.
Mm. Okay, well, this is, for me, kind of vexing a proposition, not so much because I, you know, look, I understand the a bit of the history about around anti-Semitism and the way Jews stand in for the kind of destruction that capitalism brings of traditional forms of culture and ways of life. But what is vexing to me is the difference between modernity and capitalism.
I don't think there is a difference.
Okay. So you would say then that because it seems like there's all these cultural consequences of capitalist production, which we call modernity, but they're very it's very difficult to trace out from, say, the MCM1 formulation of capitalist accumulation, trace that to, or make a connection from that to, the sense that people have that they're more isolated, or that institutions like the church are no longer serving their same function, or that family life is more fraught with peril and instability. I mean, you can try to, and I think smart people have, but do you think that capitalist production itself is the floor, or maybe the driver of what we call modernity?
Yes. There is a very distinguished line of thinkers in a Marxian tradition who are not that well known in the Anglo-American world, except among, you know, small groups of intellectuals, people like Lukács, people like Adorno, who very carefully analyzed features of modernity in terms of capitalism. If you don't think of capitalism in terms of simply class exploitation and profit seeking, but really as a cultural form and a dynamic cultural form. The word modernity for me is way too loose. It's much too loose as a term. And one of the things that led me to this analysis of a capitalism and anti-Semitism was the difficulty people have of using the term modernity and the Nazis. For quite a while, the Nazis were considered to be a revolt against modernity, right? They want to go back to the nice Middle Ages, etc., etc. But that doesn't fully work, because the Nazis were perfectly happy to accept and even accelerate some dimensions of what we can call modernity, like technology, and reject others. And this would be, I think, a little too complicated for a podcast, but I tried to show how a sophisticated theory of capital allows one to distinguish between those aspects of modernity, or I would say capitalism, that Nazism attacked, and those that it defended, thinking that they were natural. And so I thought that the category of capitalism allowed for a more differential analysis, whereas modernity, you know, it used to be until about 1970, the Nazis were just seen as anti-modern. After 1970, they became seen as like the modern movement, bureaucratic, etc., etc. And neither side is adequate. So there was also a theoretical problem I was trying to to reach, to discuss when I use the theory of capital, not simply that I begin a priori with capital and everything follows from that.
So what? How would you distinguish this cultural form of capitalism from maybe a more orthodox Marxist understanding of capitalism as a process of exploitation and the creation of abstract value through production, you know, in conjunction with the market? What where's the shift from that economic understanding of capitalism to a cultural understanding of capitalism, and how is it justified?
Well, first of all, it's both. It's both economic and cultural and social. And it's the categories themselves. I think that a lot of people have not, you know, people read Marx's Capital and a lot of them read, you know, the long excursus on terrible forms of exploitation, but they don't take very seriously his very careful construction of categories, commodity as being abstract and concrete at one and the same time, as a form of practice that people in their everyday lives begin to treat objects and themselves as being both abstract, that is, all human beings being equal, or the objects as having everything. The objects have one thing in common, which is that you can buy them with money, which means that their only difference is, does it cost $10 or $1,000 on the one hand? On the other hand, each object is specific, otherwise you wouldn't buy it. And it's this dualism that people like Lukács and Adorno began to elaborate as creating a kind of a dualism in Western thought. But it's not Western in the sense that it didn't exist in the 13th century. It's Western in the sense that it's modern capitalist thought, this dualism. And I took this dualism and, in a sense, ran with it, with the question of anti-Semitism.
Right. Well, does that help? Yeah, it does. I think that I could very easily just want to dive in on these kinds of abstract questions, and maybe I will ask one more follow-up on that, which is, I'll just say that I found myself more and more attracted to dualism and maybe Cartesian dualism, not in the sense that I believe in the mind-body split in a spiritual way or believe in the soul precisely, but just in so much as in order to hold on to dialectical thought and to understand value in capitalist society, it seems like dualism is real, like that there really, we really live in a world that is riven with dualism, and that to deny that is a big mistake. And also that I see efforts to deny dualism either by embracing absolute difference and plurality, or by looking for a singularity, as being ultimately very conservative movements. That, like, for instance, Deleuze to me, it becomes a conservative thinker as he kind of embraces one side of capitalism, the plurality and the productive, you know, realm of the commodity, where you can just find all this variation and an absolute difference and physical objects, and, you know, this. But I want to embrace dualism, but at the same time, it sounds like what you're saying to me, anyway, is that this, to get beyond capitalism, we will have to get beyond this dualism in practice.
Yeah, I agree with you completely. That is to say, and it's a problem, I think, it has historically been a problem for the left. I think retrospectively, you could say that the left has veered from one side of the dualism to the other. If and of course, I'm speaking, you know, in I'm really painting with a very broad brush.
Yeah.
But if the classical left, the working class left, the Marxist left, emphasized universalism and the idea that the bourgeoisie talks universalism, but in fact they don't effect it, effecting it would really mean a society of equality, you know, then there's the reaction against it, certainly on the level of movements beginning in the late 60s, where people, women, people of color, begin to say, well, this abstract universalism, in a sense, negates our specificity. Mm-hmm. And I think one could argue that the pendulum swung way too far in that direction. That I think there were people who were trying to understand, to come up with a new form of universalism that encompassed difference. I think a lot of socialist feminism did that, or does that. But I think that a lot of what passes for left-wing thought now has become essentially tribal. And the idea that the general is simply, if you add up all the oppressed groups, I think it's a losing proposition. It says nothing really about a future society, and it generates an enormous backlash.
The problem here is that, well, we can say that, you know, the people have either swung too far towards the universalist side or to plurality and difference. We can say that, but in this moment, I think the temptation is to move back into universality, at least amongst people like myself, and without really thinking through how to hold on to difference. And it just seems like, you know, there's back and forth, which is, I think, maybe the definition of dualism or this dialectical moment.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Is very difficult to break from. I have trouble conceiving it.
It's difficult. If I'm you know, giving the sketch of an analysis, that absolutely doesn't mean that I think that the answer is in my back pocket.
Revolutionary action.
Hi, Dr. Betty Brown here. The topic is German Expressionism.
Revolutionary action.
Expressionist artists were some of the most passionate and troubled artists of the early 20th century.
Revolutionary action.
They sought to challenge, rebel against, and certainly comment on the state of the world in Germany. And they did it with really powerful and compelling art.
Revolutionary action.
I want to mention two German Expressionist artists whose work continues to move me. The first is Kate Kollwitz, who was a sculptor, but most importantly, a printmaker. She started her career doing work that supported political action of workers, rebelling against the abuses of factory owners who cut their pay and cut their benefits and led them to starvation.
Revolutionary action.
Another German artist who stayed under Hitler in protest the horrible abuses of that leader was John Hartfield, who took his name, an American name, as a sign of protest, and he used collage and photomontage as a way to protest Hitler's political abuses.
Revolutionary action.
Hartfield was the first artist in the world to realize that the simple technique of photomontage could become a powerful political weapon. The same editing techniques that create cinema make photomontage when applied to stills. These basic methods of assembling images run through film, television, photography, and advertising.
Good morning, Mr. Cooper. Today you are going to brush your teeth 42% cleaner with Sunbeam's new revolutionary action. Up and down and around at the same time. It can clean 42% better than ordinary hand brushing.
Let's talk about anti-Semitism again, because either in this essay or in a speech or lecture that you gave, you mentioned that the way the Jews were treated by people after the Holocaust, in other words, the way the Holocaust was understood, was shaped by whether or not we were on the universalist side of that dualism or on the side of difference. So maybe you could speak to that.
Well, certainly in the decades following World War II, with a significant exception in the early 50s that I'll get to in a second, the Holocaust itself was seen really as a footnote to the history of World War II. And you could see this both in the communist East and in the capitalist West. In the East, you have a lot of monuments. Many monuments were put up by the Soviet Union and by communist regimes in, you know, the Warsaw Pact countries that honored the victims of Nazism, but never mentioned the Jews. A very peculiar thing that, let's say, outside of Kiev in Ukraine, in 1941, the Nazis, with the help of Ukrainian irregulars, shoot 33,000 Jews in 2 days in a place called Babi Yar, 2 or 3 days. And years later, there's a monument put up for the innocent civilians. They were shot as Jews. They weren't shot as innocent civilians. And this happens over and over again. And in a sense, there's a kind of a communist universalism that buried the specificity of the Holocaust. And the same thing happened in the West. You may or may not be familiar with, you know, a really pretty good and powerful film by Alain René from 1955 called Night and Fog. And in Night and Fog, if you don't know the history, you would never know that the Jews, the political deportees, and the people who were deported in order to do slave labor are not the same. You know, he shows you the piles of shoes from Auschwitz, and he never mentions the Jews once. But the other deportees were not gassed.
And the reason this is so significant, that they're overlooking the Jews when it comes to the Holocaust, is not only because it erases Jewish suffering from history, and not only because it's a sort of a redoubling of the crime against Jewish people in a way, but also because it is a way to avoid the very difficulty that the attempted extermination points to. In other words, that, you know, you miss what happened. You're not seeing how, I'll say, modernity or capitalism produced this moment.
Yes, but not only that. You think that because the Nazis were anti-Semites and racists, you being an anti-fascist, an anti-Nazi, you're going to be completely universalist. And if you mention the Jews, well, you're being a little particularistic.
Mm-hmm. Right. You're being racist to mention the Jews.
It's like, you know, Sartre writing at the time that the Jew is really made by the non-Jew, which I think came as a big surprise to a lot of Jews.
Right. Similar things are said about blacks in America, that it was whiteness that created the black. Do you think that is more true?
I am very suspicious of the category of whiteness. I think that it's a way of avoiding, a real analysis of the racism that's involved with slavery and that, outlived slavery and what its sources are. And I think it also really doesn't allow one to get a handle on why it seems that there's been a real spike in working class racism in the last 40 years. And I think that to call it all whiteness is to actually blur what's been going on. Because if you call it whiteness, then you're falling into this thing that a lot of middle class kids like to do about, white privilege. But the thing about the white working class in the last 40 years, which now exploded in our face with Trump, is that they've been declining. They've been in very bad shape. So for them to hear that they're privileged is a bad joke. I'm not trying to condone their racism at all. But if you just use the term whiteness, what you're not getting at is what kind of problems are generative of this intense racist backlash that unfortunately we're living through right now.
Right. I created a little YouTube video and I took an excerpt from one of your talks that is on YouTube and put it in the middle of this video to try to. So thank you for letting me do that without permission, I hope.
That depends. What did you take?
I took a little excerpt about anti-Semitism, about what we're discussing now. And the reason I took it was because I wanted to try to explain how you could look to the material causes behind the upsurge in alt-right or fascist or ideological racist movements. You could try to understand them without condoning them. And why it was important to understand them as a product of the kind of alienation that capitalist societies produce, and just what that alienation is. And so I put a little excerpt from you in the middle of this video, maybe 30 seconds or so. And what I got in the YouTube comments, and YouTube comments are, not the greatest source for any kind of information. They're not worth much. But one of the comments I got there was that I had failed to speak to how this was a moment of white supremacy, and I failed to talk about how the alt-right was targeting black people. And my response was that while that the racism against black people was sort of a constant, and because it was sort of a constant, it didn't really explain this particular political moment. And that, especially if you want to look to the economic crisis as playing into this particular moment, it was better to understand the anti-Semitism, to look to the anti-Semitism as an explanation, or, at least as something that would point in the direction of the cause of the problem. But there was I think in the United States especially, there's it's almost as if anti-Semitism doesn't exist in the United States, even when it does.
No, I think that that's right. And I think that people of my generation, or at least some people in universities, Nazism wasn't that far in the past. So you have a whole generation of, at that time, young scholars and intellectuals who are very focused on Nazism, on anti-Semitism, etc. But that moment passed. That moment passed, and I think that you've had several generations of critical or oppositional young people for whom this isn't a category and they don't even know what it means. They think that, you know, well, you have anti-black racism, you have anti-Muslim racism, you have anti-Jewish racism. They're all the same thing. They're not. And it's terrible if people get into, unfortunately, it happens all the time, a kind of a race of or calculus of which is the worst and who suffers the most.
That might be useful in some ways to know, but it isn't going to help you understand the phenomenon enough to change it.
No, and for people on the fascist right, their racism goes hand in hand with anti-Semitism. May I tell you about a Nazi comic book that was distributed in Chicago in the summer of 1966 when Martin Luther King led these marches in Marquette Park to draw attention to segregated housing? As I'm sure you know, the response by the people who lived there tended to be violent, really violent. And the American Nazi Party was there in force. And they distributed a comic book, which I had, and I wish I had. I don't know what I did with it. It was very, very interesting. It was, the first half is sort of two superheroes are fighting. One is white man, and that's, what was the name of the head of the American Nazi Party? Lincoln Rockwell, I think. He's in one, and Muhammad Ali is in the other. And Muhammad Ali is presented, of course, in unspeakably racist terms. I won't even go into a description of the kind of superhero outfit he was wearing. And the Muhammad Ali character is immensely strong, but he doesn't have the smarts of white man. So eventually white man outtricks him and removes the threat. But at this point, we're only halfway through the comic book. And so white man says, well, I've won this battle, but it will continue. And why? You turn the page. There is this Jew who's called Mighty Matzah, the Jew from outer space, who has been directing all of this. And the black movement is simply being manipulated by the Jews. Just as in Europe, the working class movement was simply manipulated by the Jews. So the Jews are the arch manipulator, and it would become, it's a historical irony if people who are focused on racism think that if you talk about anti-Semitism, that takes away from racism and vice versa.
Right. Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, this is the conspiracy theory, right? I mean, that every social ill and therefore every social movement in reaction to those social ills is the fault of the Jews. That's
right. And now we've got a name for it, and in let's say Central Europe, which is where I am right now, and that's Soros. George Soros plays exactly the role that the elders of Zion used to play. And he's got his tentacles everywhere, and he's basically responsible for the migration problem. So Islamophobia and anti-Semitism just meet beautifully in this form of fascist anti-Semitism. Americans seem to be very blind to that.
Right. Unless they're caught in it on the far right, then they're not blind to it at all. But I mean, if
no, and Jewish communities, because in fact, it seems that there are more hate crimes committed against Jews than Muslims in the United States in the past 3 years.
It's so ugly. But one thing that I notice about it is that it relies on a certain understanding of the world in which essentially you can always trace anything that's happening socially back to somebody's will or some group's will. That there are never any unintended consequences, that we never, set up the dominoes and then have them do things that we don't expect, or, you know, that it's everything is willed. And that understanding of the world, I think, is fairly pervasive. I don't think that's a right-wing understanding. I don't think it's fair to call it right-wing. This, for me, is like the number one thing that the left can try to understand and then communicate, is that the social ills of the world are not fundamentally a product of anyone's will, and they're not fundamentally even exclusive. They're not exclusively or fundamentally political. In other words, it's not like there's a state that's in charge of capitalism. It's not like it's America that then goes around imposing all these social ills across the world. But it is difficult to get people to, you start sounding, I don't know, like you're not militant enough, not radical enough, if you try to blame an abstract system of social interaction rather than a group or a political project.
I agree, but that's one of the reasons why there always was a need for something called left theory. The whole point of theory, if it's just simply that it's the fault of this guy or that guy, you don't need theory for that. And the kind of immediacy that these radicals call radical always misses the mark. I think an example of what you were talking about is the real problem, which I had alluded to in a different context earlier in our conversation, of the loss of manufacturing jobs in the United States. It's true that a lot of plants moved to Mexico or to China. What's also true is that that's not the ultimate problem. The ultimate problem is that these jobs are slowly disappearing, period, with the development of capitalism. The proletariat is shrinking, and that has to do with the logic of capital. So I was very disappointed that, you know, that Bernie Sanders, he thinks it's also just trade policy. We have a gigantic issue and nobody's talking about it because it's not just trade. And anyway, so now, you know, Trump is going to blow up NAFTA. He blew up the Trans-Pacific instead of making it more friendly for labor. He just blows it up And the results is not going to be that we're going to return to the 1950s. It's going to be about as disastrous as Brexit is going to be for the Brits. And you would expect the left to try and think a little more about the problem because, you know, an interesting little factoid is the share of American manufacturing in American GDP has not fallen in a half a century. Manufacturing jobs have disappeared, not manufacturing. And people make a big mistake if they think the two are the same.
Right. It's automation that is that's the source of the decline in manufacturing jobs and not, yeah. Yeah. And that is a problem that the only solution I see for it, if you remain within capitalism, is some sort of massive depression where there's a destruction of capital, whether it's abstract or physical. And then you might see a return of manufacturing jobs. But, you know, that would be a short.
That will never be on the same scale. You can produce cars, even if all the plants were back in the United States, they would not employ nearly the same number of people as Detroit did in its heyday.
Right, right.
So we have to begin thinking about not full employment, but how do we think of a post-industrial work society? Does the left have anything to say to that?
The problem is that when you have so much automation, those industries tend to be to struggle in terms of profitability. So it's not as though the closer you get to fully automated, the more economic crisis you're going to have, not just in terms of unemployment, but, you know, in terms of profitability as well.
Well, that's true. But nevertheless, what really affects people is whether they're employed or not.
Well, that's true. But I mean, if you had an industrial base that was fully automated, that was profitable, theoretically, which you really can't have fully automated industry.
Right. But let's take it as a hypothetical.
Right. As a hypothetical, then you could create, for instance, information jobs, service jobs, entertainment jobs, you know, all sorts of, you could redirect money into all these other sectors, including, you know, sectors that are really just operating through rent. And people would be employed and people would have enough, even though they were not the source of value. The automation was.
But yes, but
unfortunately, humans are always a source of value, and that won't work. You know, but
no, that wouldn't work. A and B, the country that's least in a position of doing what you just suggested is the United States. Because its federal government is strong in some respects, but it's really not a national government. You've got all these states. You can't do things like in the 70s when I lived in Germany. Germany used to have a fairly healthy and vibrant textile producing sector. The government saw that it was going under. It couldn't compete with textiles from Eastern Europe. And then later, of course, from China. But what they did was a massive government program to retrain textile workers. Yeah, but you need a massive program, and you don't have that in the States.
Yeah, you're just talking about retraining is itself a big hurdle to jump over. And if you even.
Right. But it's retraining based on sort of, as it were, a cold-eyed analysis of what's happening. You see that the textile branch is in trouble. You don't start with massive, you know, propaganda against the Poles or against the Poles and the Chinese, but you deal with it.
So how do you think that the what do you think that the far left that's most concerned about fighting fascism should be doing to fight fascism right now? Where would you point people who are very concerned about anti-Semitism and very concerned about racism and concerned that we're losing whatever, you know, bourgeois forms of civility and democracy and all of that? What would you say would be the most effective way to struggle against these anti-Semitic movements?
Yeah, well, you just asked me what used to be called the $64,000 question.
Right. Now it would be $64 million probably, right, because of inflation.
Right. I'm not sure. I do know that I've never been a fan of the Black Blocs. They made their appearance in Germany in the 70s. And they've now appropriated for themselves Antifa. There's a lot of Antifa groups in Germany, which are not like that. It's not just a matter of being a street fighting man and going out and smashing the Nazis. I mean, there has to be more than that. And I think there has to be much more of an anti-fascist culture. And the problem that I have is that fascist culture essentializes, and I hate to say this, too much of the left has been infected with the bug of essentializing. I think the way whiteness is used as a category is an essentializing category, basically.
Do you think it reproduces an anti-Semitic structure? It's sort of formal.
It can. Certainly, the black nationalist corner from which, you know, Coates originates was anti-Semitic. There's no question about it. And when I read that there are at least some people in the Black Lives Matter movement in Chicago who think that Farrakhan is, you know, to be emulated, well, this is just depressing. This is just depressing, and it's reactionary. And I don't care who they are. It's reactionary.
So one problem I have is that when you work in the realm of theory, and I'm not a great theorist or anything, but I try to basically try to understand what's already been done and say it in lay terms, you know. When you work in that level, you're not speaking immediately enough to get people excited. Some people get excited, but it seems like a slow process, and in a state of emergency, it seems too slow. What would you say to that?
I agree with that, and I don't know what the solution is, and not because of theory itself, but because in the United States, there is an enormous gap between the people who do theory and the people who regard themselves as activists. A lot of activism is very anti-intellectual in the United States. It's not necessarily in other countries. It's not because of activism per se. So there aren't the same kinds of possibilities of transmission of theory to things that are more directly political and to groups that are outside of a theoretical context. You know, you don't have the same sort of public and you don't have the same sort of party structure, which makes it very, very hard in the United States. And I wish that I had a program. I don't. I really don't. And I agree that something has to be undertaken. But I think that one of the things that has to be undertaken is rethinking whether the politics of the left should only be identity politics. whether because I don't think it's enough to say if you put together, you know, various oppressed minorities, however defined, you're going to have a majority. No, it's got to be tied, to come back to what you said at the beginning, it's got to be tied to a different notion of universalism. If it's universalist, it has to have a vision for society as a whole.
When you target identity politics as something to criticize, you end up with a motley crew of strange bedfellows. And at the moment, the one that bothers me the most isn't the right wingers, although they're in there. It's the way a certain segment of the establishment of the Democratic Party is talking about identity politics and trying to move away from identity politics. And the kind of fetters that are put in place on movements, you know, that basically like electoralism is the justification for moving away from identity politics. We got to win those white votes. And it just seems to me like a losing proposition rhetorically. And also it's really limiting the realm of, you know, acceptable thought, because you're really accepting quite a lot when you take on that position. You're saying, yeah, the only solutions can come from the state. The only problems are problems of policy, and so on and so on.
I mean, I've been out of the country, as you know, and I haven't been following the Democratic Party. I think there's a difference between saying, in a narrow sense, we've got to move away from identity politics because we have to appeal to white voters. Because that kind of implies we have to appeal to them where they are. Whereas I'm suggesting a different move away from identity politics that perhaps could appeal much more broadly, but not to people where they are, but would necessarily appeal to them. Identity politics, of, you know, first of all, usually forgets that it's a minority movement. And somehow the majority is expected to act out of a moral insight or guilt or something. But there's nothing in it for them. But the country's in such bad shape, there's something in it for everybody if you had decent, even social democratic policies. But that's different than appealing to where they are.